Thank you for asking me to come here tonight. This is really exciting for me because, I did do my degree here, so it's wonderful to come back and feel that I've made it. What I want to talk about tonight is something I've never sort of talked about before, and it's been exciting coming up with this speech tonight. So thank you for listening. I was diagnosed with Meniere's disease in 1999, and that's the same year I moved to Australia to begin graduate study at Adelaide Uni. Meniere's disease is an inner ear imbalance disorder that causes a whooshing and a sense of fullness and hearing loss in one of my ears. And it also causes severe vertigo. So feeling like walking on a canoe is really, really common. Sometimes, the slightest movement of my head while I'm chewing food can make me feel sick. And sometimes there's full-blown attacks where the room spins quite violently. These can last for several hours, and 7 hours is the longest I've gone yet. And the world spins the entire time, and the sufferer vomits the whole way through. And most people who've been infected with Meniere's, they're in their 60s or older. They might experience Meniere's symptoms on and off for a few months to a few years. But I was told at 25 that because I was so young, that I would probably have it for the rest of my life. And I've just turned 40, and I still have it. When I was diagnosed, my family and close friends were all living in America. So you can probably imagine how alone I felt through that whole ordeal. The disease is not very common, and I couldn't find any support groups. So I naturally tried to write about it. I just finished my first attempt at a novel, and I needed a break from prose, so poetry became my so-called outlet. But every time I tried to express my illness on page, I became really angry. And I was angry because I was sick, and this was affirmation of it. But I was also angry because what I was writing was really overly dramatic, and it was just really bad. I was sick for about 70% of 99 to 2002, and thank goodness for getting pregnant, because it does wonderful things to a person's body. But during that time, I was never happy with any Meniere's poem I ever tried to write. So skip forward to 2007, and I just finished my PhD in creative writing, which was a long and really ridiculously arduous journey, because I did the master's and the PhD together. And I was sick for the first half, and then I was popping out babies the second half, so it took me a very long time. I didn't really care for the novels I wrote during the master's or the PhD, but I was really proud of them. But there just seemed to be this sense of urgency missing from both of those novels that I only felt in the first novel I had written, which I'd written before I got sick. So when I finished up at uni, I knew I wanted to write something just for the sake of writing, not for any letters after my name. That sort of freedom was really exciting for me, and I was pregnant again when I started doing it, so the Meniere's was quiet. So I really got to put my energy into the writing. I started writing Pursuing Love and Death, which is a story of a dysfunctional family preparing for the daughter's wedding. In the lead up to the occasion, we meet Luna, who is the daughter and the bride, and she's nervous that she maybe just wants a baby and not a man. There's her brother Ginsburg, who is openly gay, but falling in love with his wife. His plot line makes sense if you read the book. I've actually thought long and hard about how I could work that one out. Velma is Luna's mother, and she's having a midlife crisis. She's sleeping with a man 20 years her junior, and she's sort of pining over her ex-husband, who's Luna's father, even though she left him decades ago. And Darren is the uncle, and he's a morbidly obese man who's become so obsessed with John Kennedy Toole's hilariously brilliant book, A Confederacy of Dunces. If you haven't read it, that's what I really want this book to do, is make people read that book. He's so obsessed with that book that his life dramatically and tragically transforms. And then there's Graham, who's the father, and he's an obituarist, and he's decided to write his own obituary. Graham's story is the one I began with, and for me, it's the pivotal story in the book. So I'm just going to start by reading the first couple pages of the book. And this chapter is titled, Light at the End of the Tunnel in Graham's Left Inner Ear. What seemed like an endless past played in his mind as he tried to determine whether he was a good enough man. A clutter of memories like a rainbow of marbles rolling on cement. Spilled suitcases on the floor, crumpled clothes from 6 decades, and warped, bristled toothbrushes. Collages of photos snipped of any superfluous space, some only close-ups of eyes. He decided it was the persistent memories, both the good and the bad, at times complete with sensory detail and crisply recorded dialogue, that must have been the pivotal moments in his life. The grandness of it all, he said to himself, staring at the full moon's suggestion on his ceiling. The pittiness, he mumbled, then tried to close his eyes. It's not as if he was dying or even contemplating suicide. It's just that the illness was making him think about mortality. Clearly, he was at a crossroads and about to choose acceptance. Acceptance does that for people, allows them to think deeper. So perhaps it was accepting life in an unsuitable way that made him think about death. Could he have been a better man? Certainly, he had been the best that he could be, but was that good enough? Good enough for whom? Was he the best judge of good enough? Who the hell is the best judge of good enough? Did his children like him? Not love him, like him. His eyes sprang open as if desperate to see, but why had he never thought of asking the question before? Images of Luna and Ginsburg when they were small, something like 6 and 4, worked their way to Velma, their mother. Could he have saved his marriage? Should he have got married in the first place? The 6 years he was with Velma were the most passionate years of his life. They were obsessive, full of lust and anger, full of life. Velma. She had to have been his destiny, if only for a short time. She was a comet that he hadn't seen coming, and she left an enormous imprint, charred black and still smoking. And a girl. And a boy who had his chin. These questions, these revisiting of old wounds and happy days, these wide-eyed early-hour reflections had made him uneasy the past 4 nights. He had lain in his bed, dizzy and exhausted from the Meniere's disease, contemplating death, reflecting on life. And he was fidgety, anxious, morbidly alert, gripped by the prospect of his next task. It was so obvious, he had to write his own obituary. I was pretty nervous about giving my own illness to a 63-year-old male. For one, I was definitely nervous about writing a 63-year-old male. But I was also afraid he would turn out to be weak and full of self-pity. And I think he probably was in my first draft, to be fair. I just thought he would mimic my awful poetry attempts. But Meniere seemed a really interesting character quirk, and it seemed exotic, and I was an expert on it, so I didn't have to do any research. That was a good enough reason to go for it. And then when I went for it, I realized I liked it, and I liked Graham. Meniere's defines his character and his motives. It motivates his character. It causes him to obsess over writing his obituary because he's consumed by illness, and therefore, inevitably, thoughts of his mortality. In writing his obituary, he asks himself if he was good enough. This becomes a major theme throughout the book, not just for Graham, but for all of the characters. So Meniere's is actually at the center of this book. Didn't really know I was doing that until I had finished that draft. Also, by giving Graham this major complication, I got to indulge in my own illness. I got to be as woe is me as I wanted to be, because fiction allows the author some distance from the truth. Whereas for me, poetry has never allowed any distance from the truth. This was no longer my disease. It was Graham's disease. So I can tell you what an attack for me is like, and you might feel like you have to say, I'm sorry. And then there will be this awkwardness because we've been sharing this little bit of personal history, and then we've suddenly become really close, even though we might not want to be close. So if I tell you what Meniere's is like for Graham, I don't have to deal with any of that, neither do you. I've got nothing to do with it. I don't have to feel awkward, and I can keep writing, and you don't have to feel awkward, and you can keep reading. So what I'm going to do is read just a little bit about the attack. The only thing you need to know about this to catch on, I suppose, is that he's never talked to anybody about it. He's pretty much been talking to himself about it this most of this book. And he finally sits down and talks to his neighbor, Sharon, who's going to be his love interest in the future. Sharon sat and stretched her long legs, sighed as if happy for the day, or perhaps for the chance to relax from the big clean. So the wedding soon. You must be excited for Luna. Excited for Luna. Now there was a thought. And all of this self-made hoopla with the obituary and his frenzy over his illness, it suddenly struck Graham that he hadn't really thought much about how Luna must be feeling, or how he, as the father of the bride, should be feeling for his daughter. What was he feeling? I'm not sure excited is the word. Where was he going with this? What was he about to say? I thought you looked a bit apprehensive this morning. What's wrong, Graham? Graham wondered how she'd sensed it. He thought he'd hidden his awkwardness with masculine grace and dignity, but women could be amazing creatures. Their instincts were so often selfless. The very fact that Graham was looking into Sharon's eyes, which already mirrored a sympathetic pain, made Graham want to open up to her. He felt impetuosity overtake him. It wasn't the way he had planned his confession, but life is what it is. I've been sick lately. Sharon's face crumpled in a question and a gentle pleading to go on. I have Meniere's disease. Oh my God, what's that? Visions of lepers, people with hair falling out, yellow-skinned men screaming in pain or withering away silently? Graham saw this in her face and he had to smile, suddenly feeling stupid. Yes, the term disease does make it sound rather dramatic, doesn't it? Graham sipped tea, then leaned forward on his elbows, feeling a great weight being lifted from his shoulders, a great release from his heavy head. It's a bloody difficult imbalance disorder is what it is, and it all began to feel so natural. My inner ear, I tell you, it's hard to get through the day. I fall, I vomit, I've lost my hearing in the left ear only to acquire the noise of the ocean. It's just bloody difficult. How long have you had it, Graham? And this is what he needed, the give and take of a conversation, the sound of his own voice making the disease seem common. A couple of years, I suppose. When I look back, I can remember hints of it. Vertigo while watching a bird fly from a tree. Small things, in hindsight. But it's been bad for the past 5 months. I don't know. It's hard to just walk most days, and driving's a thing of the past. The flute, too. With an air of profound concern in her voice, Sharon asked the obvious. Why haven't you said anything? Truly, this was a question worth asking, but how to reply? Because I'm a damaged old man who can't communicate with people who love me? I suppose I denied it for a while, didn't know how to begin talking about it. Graham absentmindedly took a bite of the cake, the sweetness telling him under no circumstances should he have another bite. He chewed it begrudgingly, then swallowed, only to make room for the tea that would put balance into his digestive system. You're the first person I've told. Sharon reached out and touched Graham's hand. It was exactly what he'd needed. The warmth of skin on skin. The feel of life rushing through two bodies and connecting in one place of comfort. This was the thing that was hot. This was the thing he was supposed to grab. Graham turned his hand to hold Sharon's, and without realizing the magnitude of his actions, he squeezed it, held on, allowed for the comfort to fill his body. And just as he was about to thank the day for handing itself over to him in that moment of total release, Graham felt the beginnings of an attack. We'll just skip forward a bit. He had made it to the garden to stand among some tranquility and make sure he wasn't imagining it. To make sure he hadn't misunderstood the signs, because the closeness with Sharon had maybe freaked him out. But then he began to wrestle. Is this another one? Just paranoid. Feels like it. Shit, not the bloody vomiting again. Cannot do it now. Not another fucking attack. Though he'd expected it to be coming the last few days, there was just no way to prepare. After his assessment of the situation and quick stint at rationalization, I'll get through this, I can do this, it's only a few hours, maybe five, I'm not going to die. His anger and fear synchronized and created a new emotion entirely. The ground beneath his knees turned left, the air around his head turned right. He fell, tasted earth, and vomited, dribbled vomit onto the earth, and lay there in his vomit, vomiting, dribbling the vomit, vomiting over and over and over again, as if too much alcohol was in his system and he had the spins, such a lighthearted term. Of course, that only lasts until the alcohol has left, either in a toilet or in some bushes or on the dirty floor of a nightclub. For Graham, the spinning would continue long after the first vomit, and long after the first bile, and long after the first dry heave, possibly several hours. This was a full-blown Meniere's attack. I'm just going to skip a little bit more. 3 hours later, and Graham still spun, slightly less than during his attack, slightly more than on a normal day. Finally, he had enough strength to leave his garden, where an acid patch would fight off all growth for the season, and he'd be reminded of being alone and helpless on the ground every morning when he watered with the buckets he'd collected from his shower. His first few steps made him nauseated, and though there was nothing left in his stomach, he managed one last vomit, stomach bile. It burned his throat, and his eyes stung from boiling tears that refused to either fall or subside. He walked to his shed with only the thought of marijuana. It would slow down the spinning, and he would be able to sleep. The wedding dinner was tonight. He wouldn't be able to attend. He'd be in recovery mode. Considerable sleeping time was to be had for at least the next 36 hours. The wedding was in 2 days. He had no choice. He was going. Before the pipe, the telephone. "Smitty, it's me," the answering machine. "I can't make dinner tonight. Tell Luna sorry, some gastro thing. I need to sleep it off. Tell her I'll be right for the wedding." After a pause, "Good luck." His brother would handle things. He could not phone Luna for fear he'd have to explain. Even after the morning with Sharon, there was still the fear of explaining. Back out to the shed, and it all seemed so awful. Each step proved he was regaining his equilibrium, what he'd had of it to begin with. But each step was heavy, his body burdensome yet feeling slight and empty. It was the coming down that brought on the depression. The attack was a high, a hideous high, and the aftermath brought him to new levels of low. This one would be lower than the garden bed, puddled with the half-digested remains of his breakfast. As the smoke set in and began to settle his world, he thought, what is a man's worth when he is alone in his vomit? The ever-present obituary. So before I go on, I just want to tell you that I'm sort of touching on the doom and gloom parts of this book, but it is really funny. And I tried to sort of do the John Irving thing where you can balance out humor and tragedy, but you're just hearing some of the tragedy tonight. So with that scene, I tried to make the prose as attractive as I could so that the foulness of the attack was intriguing rather than revolting. The philosopher Gay Sercello would refer to the attack scene as a flower of evil, a place where one might find beauty amidst filth. So he likens the style to the phenomenon in which a fresh gaping wound will produce a profusion of gorgeously vivid blood. A rupture in a slug's skin can produce a gracefully swelling mound of beautifully smooth, creamy white guts. Or as the poet Baudelaire said in A Corpse by the Roadside, there is beauty in the sensuously pulsing rhythm of the flies as they swarm up and down over the putrid vulva. Now in my case, Graham's vomit is cause for another existential moment in the book. And I think those are beautiful moments in life. Again, this is character motivation, and it's another chance for me to sort of vent. I learned a lot about how I really feel about living with Meniere's when I wrote Pursuing Love and Death. Like Mark Twain said, I don't know what I think about something until I've written about it. So I can never be sure if I did Graham justice and held back with him enough so as to not overwrite him, but he was my favorite character. And I fought for him when people said they didn't like him. And then I think I touched him up to make him a little bit less woe is me. But I can never know this. I'm too close to him. After a few years of writing and rewriting the novel about Meniere's, writing about Meniere's felt really natural to me. And so I thought I'd return to poetry. These are the first two poems I wrote about the illness. The first is from a book called Letters to My Lover from a Small Mountain Town. And the themes in this book are about sort of the dual space of home from a transnational person And I wrote this while I was living in America, after years of not living in America. And it's called Everything is Possible Today. Today, everything is possible. A pound will fly from each arm as I flap madly, illustrating flight. The wind which blows my head in spirals will slow to a breeze, reminding me of the distant South Australian sea, while laundry will dry on our ragged clothesline and begin to fold itself. We balance ourselves precariously, slanted to the side of loving too much and snubbing responsibility. Thank heavens for you, one leg longer than the other, so balance has never been an issue. And me and my ear, I will not hear of it. Remember that night we impromptu embraced and slowly began to fall? Imbalance pushed us toward the ground, the kitchen grit you ignored while I imagined it multiplying as we slept in our disheveled bed, so comfortable with touching, we chose not to. Remember how we held ourselves up, so that alone we fell, together we flew? I'm still flapping my wings, our daughter does it in return. The weeds smell sweeter than lavender bloom, and ants have decided to build us a second home. And the next poem is called The Kitchen Floor. I have no handle on linoleum. I only sweep the dust of our lives caught in the crevices of our living. I only spot clean where the dog drooled and the black earth stuck. I only complain I should be writing a poem about lino and the other things which make this a home. I chose red, like the deserts of Utah, for the living room wall where the fire burns. Utah. Where faces appear in stones and sand slows you down. We once said that Utah, outside of Adelaide, was the only place we felt at home. The red wall hasn't faded after 10 long years, still singing the story of a woman pregnant again and painting the home she left behind within the home she has. Wood splinters on the throw rug, the dog's hair nesting with the dust bunnies, fingerprints and Legos. I put up my feet and stare at the wall, seeking my space to breathe. I have no handle on clean. Think of the mice, the summer ants. Remember the day I went to bed and rose 3 weeks later? Our bedroom became the house, or all I needed to know of it. The kitchen and its liveliness gave me the spins while my feet stuck fast to the linoleum floor. Give me a broom or give me death, I sobbed, leaning against the cupboards, and I chose the closest option. A bed and a dozen literary novels, handpicked to make me weep. The house moaned, the house creaked, the third baby got by without me. I lift her and you and our two boys to a living which gathered in the crevices, and I swept it up when I had healed. When the heat waves came, we left our house and filled the inflatable pool under the oak tree. I waded to my calves. They pretended life was an ocean. Sometimes our skin slipped on the stink of skin on skin. Sometimes we slept outdoors. Sometimes the house was Gretel's oven and distant as that gingerbread house. Nothing is real at 46 degrees. It might as well be a fairy tale. Adelaide's heat is like wild sex, and the kitchen is no place to be. The bed's so soppy, sinking in its purple doona, and the living room drips like blood caught in a bead of sweat. Yet after that month in Utah, we came home and filled the space, such enormous space for the five of us, and we looked around as if it were our first time in a foreign land, the first time we'd seen our home, the first time we'd opened the blinds, let the rays of the sun wash the lovely grit from the linoleum floor. So with these poems, you can see I actually didn't write about illness. In fact, I wrote about being overwhelmed by both housework and love. And both poems resolve with hope and acceptance. I never mentioned the word Meniere's because it's not at all important to what I'm writing. In the first poem, I use terms like spirals and imbalance, and in the second, I use the image of the kitchen giving me the spins. And then I know I'm writing about particular moments in my memory. I'm also using metaphor. Susan Sontag wrote a wonderful book called Illness as Metaphor, in which she says that the Romantics thought of tuberculosis as a passionate disease. Someone who loves too deeply, then has refused that love, for instance, might die of it, and that person would be the hero that we all pity and, you know, want to hold up on a pedestal. And then she claims that the cancer victims in literature are depicted as characters who are not sufficiently sensual or in touch with their emotions, so they're not as revered as tuberculosis patients. Their stifling of feelings caused their cancer, so in some ways they're deserving of it. So in thinking of illness as metaphor, I'm first to look at my poems and see a connection. I refer to the disease without mentioning it by alluding to dizziness. And dizziness is something that spins you so that you lose balance and cannot hold on to anything around you. In the first poem, I see dirt as I fall to the ground, knowing it's something that's going to keep growing, yet love will save me. In the second poem, I sit among dirt, unable to sweep it up, seeing it as futile. The love, in the end, makes it really grand. Though in these poems, I indulge in writing about my own private illness by hiding behind ambiguity and metaphor. After pursuing love and death, I didn't want to fall back into overly dramatic and really bad poetry. So clearly for me, the best way around it was to be in avoidance of anything specific. But then I became angry with myself for that, just as angry as I had been all those years ago when I was failing miserably about writing honestly about being sick. If I'm following Twain, I think I'm always trying to follow his words and write about something in order to know how I feel about it, why should I be so sneaky? A writer's job is to keep growing as a writer, so I saw my only option being to strip it all back and open it up raw. So I'll just read you my latest attempt. And I wrote this less than a week ago, so it's still a first draft. And it's unabashedly titled, Trying to Write About Meniere's Disease. 1. It was a sad day when you'd come to realize your body would never be glamorous holding on to the spinning earth. But had you considered, it just might be closer to nature than all those other conventional bodies, because it was spinning too. Why had you said dizzy when the word is like giddy? Is not falling more appropriate to a bottom dweller with a head that follows like a little brother or sister? Tin tomatoes, pepperoni, soy sauce, cheeses, baba ganoush bought in a plastic container, and the crackers which had carried it to your guilty mouth. You must avoid salt, though your body craves it, being so full of the ocean. You are a lost fish. Your home is an eddy. You write about sickness in bubbles plucked from underwater screams, and we all know it cannot be an art form if the words pop before they are ever written. How could anybody read them? Too many times you've wondered if each word is monotone, then why should we sing? What is it to say poetry saves when bile dribble stains your favorite writing dress? Or to say you're tired of backstroking in circles when you close your eyes to the glaring sun? Or to say when you are sleeping in your rocking bed, which rides upon dreams and dreams of waves, you yourself are dreaming that you're trapped, that you've wrapped your body in a swinging cocoon and will emerge days later, wings and all. 2. Have you forgotten silence? You never had to put it into words because you'd always known it is the earth's limb, and you too have felt like that. Maybe more a tongue than a leg, while silence was a nostril, inhaling everything. Now you try to place it, throwing letters like paint on the wall, writing poems all through the untamable sky, the soundlessness of ants, or the photosynthesis of plants. You edit relentlessly, knowing silence is a big word, like hate and death, so best to avoid it altogether. Still, you want to talk about the sound in your left ear. You want to say it's time's droning instrument measuring the molecules that swim past your head, or time's trick of letting loose the dam that will take you under, rush you on. But it is not natural to speak without the words you've lost amidst the noise. No, none of this is natural. 3. Once you wore a dress which fit you perfectly. Health spilled from the top of the open neckline and below the slackened hemline. Your curves were so round against the silk that your body danced whenever you moved. Writing in it was like doing the rumba in your seat. Sometimes it was ballet. It is like you have taken it out of the wash to find it shrunken and dripping and torn down the middle, the threads of the seams only just hanging on. When you hold it up, you see the color has faded, as have the trees, as have the faces of your loved ones, your favorite painting, which can no longer tell its story. All are shavings of dead skin filed from the memory of your earth-worn heels. Now you have a fish tail, and are growing fins. You have no need of dresses because your scales would only snag the fabric. Now you are resigned to return to the place you crawled out of millions of years ago, thinking somewhere there must be a coral reef. So though I use metaphor to compare my sick body to a fish or to see it as a vessel that holds the ocean, I've not hidden behind metaphor, and there's nothing ambiguous about my subject matter in this poem. I've been utterly and unapologetically indulgent, and yet I don't feel embarrassed by any attempt at self-pity. Maybe my reader and I have gotten too close, but it somehow doesn't bother me as it had so many times in the past. And there's two things that interest me here, and one is this. It's a prose poem. I think writers like myself who cross genres are very lucky in that they get to choose the form of their subjects, although it's probably a little bit more instinctual decision than anything else. But then I was just hearing that David Malouf was saying, oh, I actually start writing about something and then, I start writing about something and then decide what form it's going to be. Maybe it's the opposite what I'm saying. But in either way, I'm wondering if my very detailed writing about disease, so talking about a no-salt diet or hearing loss in the left ear, I wonder if it has to avoid line breaks in order to somehow, in my head, avoid familiar sentimentality. So it's kind of like avoiding the old poetic term air, because you know you can use the word before, maybe. The other thing that interests me is that I've discovered acupuncture as preventative care in like pregnancy, which is the state my body was in when I was writing Pursuing Love and Death. I've experienced a 2-year reprieve from Meniere's symptoms. From severe Meniere's symptoms, I should say. So I still live with the disease daily, but only in small ways, and there's certainly no fear of a full-blown attack. So maybe it's the physical distance from the illness that allows me to get closer to it and approach it in my poetry. At any rate, I think it's safe to say I have to apologize for the blurb to this evening's event, where I said I may have found the key to writing about Meniere's in poetry. I haven't figured out anything. I've just simply written 3 poems worth saving. But what writing 3 successful poems has done for me is make me excited about the prospect of more. It's made me question my process, which only makes me want to experiment more with the pushing of boundaries, personal boundaries, metaphorical boundaries, and boundaries of form. And in mentioning form, this talk in itself is exciting for me because writing this speech was a new form for me as well. And I've decided to let tonight be a jumping stone into writing personal essays this year about writing illness, and I'm not an essayist. So thank you guys for being my audience tonight and letting me experiment out loud. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Heather. You've had some fascinating insights into Heather's creative process and also into the illness itself. To deal with the illness. I'd just like to ask if there are any questions anyone would like to.
The talk was very special. Thank you for that. I'm very interested in uncertainty, and the thing that, perhaps because of my own medical limitations, the thing that I kept thinking about while you were talking is uncertainty, and that having Meniere's would create uncertainty in your life. Now, writing, you can do it when it's okay. But talking here tonight, what would happen if you had an attack here tonight? How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, I think uncertainty is a really, really heavy word that's important to use, because I know that when I'm not well, and if I'm asked to do a poetry reading,
yes,
I just feel very untalented. I feel very, I look through the poems and I can't find a single one that's good, and you know, I feel very uncertain about what I'm doing. And so I guess that's probably why I thought, oh, well, maybe that's why I can write about it now, because I'm actually not sick. And maybe when I am sick, I am too close to it, and I do overwrite. If I had to give this speech tonight, I think I would be able to present myself okay, But I wouldn't be happy about what I was reading. I wouldn't think that anybody would care to know about it. And, you know, I would be very uncertain about what I was doing and would anybody, yeah, want to listen.
But
so
you learned to handle uncertainty is what you're saying in a way. Mightn't be great.
I guess I'm a little bit
bad, but you can do it.
I guess I'm a little bit charmed in that I am well right now, and I was well when I wrote this. I don't know yet. So, you know, all my experience in writing while being sick has really upset me. But not, you know, maybe I wasn't writing horrible stuff. Maybe I just thought I was because I was
sick.
Yeah. So, gosh, you know, but see, now that I'm doing this, I'll hopefully be able to think a little bit more clearly about these things when they do happen. And maybe I will see like, oh, Heather, you're actually not that bad. Or maybe I will go, oh, no, definitely wait till you're well again to write about it. But hopefully I'm opening my mind more, you know, by thinking about it more.
The emotions that you've written for Graham in the first few pages, they come off as very genuine from a first person view because
Thanks.
You yourself have experienced them. How much do you think it would be different to write about an illness from another perspective? So if a person doesn't have a certain disease or hasn't experienced a certain condition, tries to write about somebody else?
Yeah, that's a great question. Tom Shapcott, who taught me here when I was doing my master's degree in creative writing, said, you know, you should write about what you don't know about what you know. But I think you can also turn that around and say you should write about what you know about what you don't know. I think both of those work. And I just finished a poetry manuscript where I gave, it's kind of a narrative as well. There's a lot of women involved that were actually literary heroines that were written by male characters. And one of them is Lilith, who is a Hebrew mythological character. And she has MS. And I've never had MS. I don't have any experience with it aside from, you know, some friends that have had it. And I just decided to give her an illness so I could write again about illness, because illness is something in, you know, everybody. If you have a group of women together, somebody's going to have a serious illness more than likely. So I gave it a go, and I really thought this was going to be a great experience, but in fact I held back quite a bit and didn't explore it in the way that I had in my mind, thought it was going to be very grand. I gave it to her, I had her say a few things about it, I had her be a little bit reclusive with the rest of the group. So I did things on the surface. Aside from that, writing prose, I haven't written any more characters with an illness, but I will because I am I'm an expert on it, and I don't need to research it. I'll need to research whatever illness it is, but I think that I should be able to write what I don't know about what. Sorry, I'm going to do it the other way. I should be able to write what I know about what I don't know, which are these feelings of uncertainty, and you know, there's always feelings of depression, and you know, there are these things that accompany illness, and so. You know, I'm gonna keep going with it because, like I said, you know, we all have something. And it's funny because once you do have something serious, you find out how many people around you have something serious as well. So I think we want to read about these things, you know, anyway. So I want to write about them. Yeah.
I'm just thinking that something that's useful in this context is the concept of shame. And other people may or may not feel that's the case, but I've just finished a book by Brené Brown, Daring Greatly, in which she explores the concept of shame resilience. And I think one of the things that anyone who lives with an ongoing problem battles with, and I say this from my own experience to some degree, is a sense of shame about it. It's shame for what you can't do, it's shame for how you're perceived, it's shame for how you'll be judged, etc. And I think what she's got to say in that book is actually really useful. And I think it can... So I guess I'm just offering it forward as something that I think when I think about my own experiences of dealing with troubles of the body, I think I will go back to what I've learnt from this book and how to deal with shame effectively.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be useful to other people wanting to explore kind of problematic concepts in writing. I think the aspect of shame is a useful one.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting writing Graham because he is the total opposite of me, where he was ashamed and he did not know how to talk to people about it. And I was just one of those people who just went, oh my God, I have to tell you what's going on. And I talked about it with everybody. And I think that I felt very embarrassed about how, you know, dramatic I was. And that's the way that I have to deal with things. And maybe that's why the writing didn't quite work for me, because I was always going, oh. but it was really good writing him for me to see how the other side of it could be. Maybe I could find a balance one day. I don't know. But I certainly didn't feel shame about having an illness. I think I felt ashamed about how I handled it, which was wanting to tell the world. So maybe that's why I liked Graham so much, because he did it so differently than me. I admire that in him. But, you know, obviously he's very, you know, full of faults because of that. It causes a lot of problems in this book. So, yeah.
That brings me to the metaphor of moving on from your own experience to creating a character who's not you.
Mm.
So your experience is important in your ability to write, but I think that's a really interesting thing about being an author, rather than any of us talking about our own experience. How did you notice anything about how you shifted from talking about yourself and friends and so on,
yeah,
into writing about someone who's not you, Graham?
Well, his ex-wife, Velma, I sort of gave her my qualities in terms of being really, really dramatic and always turning everything into her. So I got to let them play off of each other. So I think, I don't think I'm like Velma at all. I certainly hope I'm not. But I did, when I became frustrated with writing about Graham, which I did become frustrated because I thought, why would he not tell his family? I mean, his whole family are in Adelaide. Why would he not do it? Whenever I got frustrated with him, I just got to take on Velma, because each character has their own story and it's written in their own sort of voice. So when I got frustrated with him, I got to move to her and make her everything that I would, I guess, presume that I am like, and just, she got to pick up where he could not go. So that maybe worked, that had a balance. Mm.
Just like to ask, do you think there's a gender difference in how these illnesses are dealt with, or are they sort of universal level that different people have something
to do with? Well, I don't know. And I do feel that, in many ways, while I was writing him, I felt like this is such a cop-out. You know, I gave this silent, shameful sort of reaction to an illness to a man, and it felt very obviously gendered, that the man would be the quiet one, you know, whereas if I'd given it to a woman, she would be really dramatic. And so I did feel that, I might be doing a disservice to the characters, or to, I guess, to the way I want to be perceived as a writer, which is not to fall into those sort of general, you know, spaces. But I don't know how to answer that. You know, my husband here has, you know, dealt with chronic pain from an accident he had, and he doesn't talk about it much. But then his mother, you know, doesn't talk about her pain either. So that could be a generational thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Can I just comment on that? I'm actually a PhD history student. I actually got diagnosed with Meniere's about a year ago. I compared to you, I think I'm pretty lucky. I've got low level. I mean, I get about a month where I feel crap, sort of pick up again. Mm. And I suppose I'm 60, so I just accepted that I kind of thought, well, you know, I've made it this far in life. But, to me, it's probably more of a pain in the ass. In a sense, like, you know, I'm a low salt diet. I don't mean to sound flippant, but just like tonight, you know, I can't.
The cheese.
Red wine or coffee or stuff like that. So it's, I guess you learn to live with it.
I've given up on all of the diets, actually. Oh, okay. It's not going to go away, so you know that's what I've been told. Because I'm young, so I just went. I'm just going to drink and eat cheese. But I mean, it has helped a lot of people. Yeah. I know what helps me is acupuncture, and I do think you just have to find. I think there's something out there for everybody, and I think diets can help a lot of people. They didn't help me because I just felt really annoyed that I couldn't have cheese and have wine. So in fact, they worked against me.
I get sort of embarrassed about telling anyone. I just say, I feel really awful tonight. Do you mind if I don't come? Or if I go to my parents or family or friends, I just take plain food. So it's more an inconvenience. And I've lost a few weeks study-wise. Different people sort of. I think I admire the way you've managed to do a PhD.
Me too.
I'm about halfway through mine, so I'd be interested in any tips to sort of maintain your motivation.
We can talk after it.
Any other questions? If not, I'd like to thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've given us some fascinating insights, both the disease and the creative process and how you operate. Really been fascinating.
Thank you.
As a token of our appreciation,
yay!
We've got a book voucher and some gift cards for you.
Great!